You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 6th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly in association with There's Nothing Like Australia.
Hello and a belated Happy New Year from the Monocle Weekly. It's episode 183. You're joined by me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck for a collection of the highlights from the year just gone. And what a year it's been.
We'll be listening back to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield's chat with Alistair Campbell, where tough questions were the order of the day.
We didn't find any weapons of mass destruction after he fell. Now, my view on that is the intelligence can't all have been wrong, and what the other thing to remember is we know that he had them, and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
And we'll be reliving a visit from the mischievous self-proclaimed piano genius, Chilly Gonzalez.
Sometimes you get to know a really gregarious, slightly socially dominant entertainer. You'll meet a guy like that, and you might like him, and then you might start to hate him a little bit. He might transgress, and then in a certain moment, he'll reveal maybe why he's like that, and you'll start to understand more about him.
And he was a gregarious one, but the genius claim just about sticks. We'll hear a song or two as well.
And we'll get a second dose of Ben Goldacre discussing the warped world of drug testing.
With the pharmaceutical industry, we're talking about a $700 billion global industry which spends twice as much of its revenue on marketing as it does on research and development. And that's something which is obviously not going to create innovative new products.
All that plus a fun spin of the globe with Simon Garfield. We'll shine a light on Afghanistan with Ben Anderson. And there may be time for a stroll of London's leafiest parks this Sunday too, as we look back on the best of the year on the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. And a belated happy new year to you, Andrew Tuck.
And to you as well, Robert Bound.
This is very formal, isn't it?
Very formal.
This is how the year's going to go from now, 2013. It's all Mr. Tuck. Mr. Bound, where the hell's your copy?
Mr. Bound, would you come and see me now?
I rather like this. This is a nice way of doing it. Do you like my tie? Smartening up 2013.
jacket as well. Going all out.
Yeah, exactly. Jacket and jeans, like Lovejoy. Don't know what I'm talking about. Don't know what's happened. Yeah, I'm still hungover from New Year.
No, we've had a nice year, haven't we?
We've had a great year. I don't know why they need to do a best of show, because presumably just a bit for me
and me. No, it has been quite nice,
actually. Of anger fell over your face there like
what?
A whole dark
just you?
Cloth of hate.
It has been nice because at the beginning of this year, well, we were letting other people get involved, and then you and me kind of took it back a bit.
It's sort of, yeah, what have we done?
We've seized the territory.
We have seized the territory. We've weed on the Monocle Weekly lamppost.
We've kicked those squatters off.
We have. Hope Tyler's listening to this. He's going to love being called that. Get off my
he
land.
He wasn't a squatter.
Get off my land.
There's always a sacred seat. There's always a place setting for Mr. Brulé.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
If he came, we'd be very happy always to have him in our presence.
Just in case, boom, coming in.
Yeah, hello, Tyler, how are you?
Hi, boom, there's a man with a cappuccino.
He's welcome
and I'm off.
He's welcome whenever he wants. But I've enjoyed it because it's funny, it's very busy in the office upstairs, and sometimes, even though we sit almost opposite, we're diagonally from each other.
This is a bit of quality time for us, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I get to hear about your week.
Because we're wearing headphones in here. That's just necessary for the studio. But sometimes upstairs, you've got to review records. Sometimes when you're writing things, it's nice to have your earphones in. It's not very sociable, but sometimes it's got to be done. Sometimes we've got our little earphones in our ears and we're sort of beavering away out there. This is going nowhere. Let's talk about the Scissor Sisters coming in last
year. Okay, I was going to say we loved each other. Okay, let's move on. And the Scissor Sisters came in.
Sisters came in, unsurprisingly, just as great conversationists and guests as they are performers and singers.
And they were very happy to pose on the front desk and pretend to be receptionists.
Yeah, they were good. Animatronic, who's super cool. She's a sort of hot receptionist, isn't she? She'd definitely get a job here. If I'm in charge of hiring.
It's because she's done that. And also Kylie, when she came in, posed on the front desk as well to have
again,
a pitch taken answering the phone.
Very suitable front desk sort of ambassador of first impressions, whatever we might call her.
Yes.
Right.
But very good.
Yeah. And she was nice as well. Did we have her on the weekly? I interviewed her and Tyler interviewed her. Those interviews will pop up probably in some other best
all over the place.
She was rock and roll.
We also had Anissa Halou, who I think was just great. She's, you know, a chef and a writer, and she was talking about Lebanon and Syria and her kind of connections, especially to Aleppo, where her family were from. I think that's the nice thing about the show. Often people come on to talk about one thing, and then they get chatting, and then you hear about, you know, a whole other world that they're involved in, because we give them a bit more time to talk, don't we, Rob?
Yeah, exactly. We kind of let them chew the cud a bit. One of the recent guests I really enjoyed was Artemis Cooper, who wrote that great book about Patrick Leigh Fermor. That was a proper old school biography. She loved the subject. She knew the subject. And that was a real kind of role. I felt like I'd sort of been in Crete in the 40s with him and stuff, speaking to her. She was a very engaging guest, wasn't she?
And amazing, because I think that book has so many elements to it. You know, there's this guy who becomes a kind of bit of a war hero. There's him as a bit of a Lothario. He's traveling. And yeah, she knew him, and she somehow got all of that over in a very short interview. And yeah, she was a very kind of generous guest, I thought.
And you liked the pub man, didn't you, Pete Brown?
He was just great.
He was such a good guest, wasn't he? He went off, didn't he, to go to his book signing, or the launch of his book at the pub.
At the pub.
I was quite jealous. I think that day I was slightly feeling a bit heady. Otherwise, I very happily
sort of tagged on.
Sort of being his book carrier.
You might not have been quite a good dude to close the show.
Exactly. And he was a good guest. And that book's been, I think that book's been well regarded. I expect lots of people got that in their stockings at Christmas. Lots of beer loving Monocle readers and listeners, I'm sure.
Yes. Okay. Well, talking about talking about stocking
like that.
Talking about stocking filling. Should we move on?
I thought you were going to say something else.
No, I wasn't going to say anything else.
Did Santa visit you this Christmas?
Yeah, but he didn't come in any stockings.
he didn't fill your stockings?
Didn't drag up, no. Drag Santa wasn't
right.
There.
We've got let's get on with the best of. So there's no Tom Edwards this week. No crystal balling into the future. The news has been cancelled, and we're taking a look back instead. So without further ado, let's hear what we've been up to. Our first interview today is a chat with the writer Simon Garfield. For Monocle 24, a station dedicated to bringing you the world in one day, possibly even one hour, Simon is our favourite kind of contemporary polymath, a writer that seems to be able to get his teeth into anything and nail it.
And he'd been on his travels too, visiting Monocle in October to discuss his book On the Map, a celebration of the cartographer's craft, tackling the history, politics and philosophy of map-making, from the ancient Greeks to Google Earth. Rob and Hugh MacDonald had the pleasure of meeting him.
Simon, thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Really nice to be here.
Now, On the Map, it's a very nice title. We've got to first explore why maps this time, because we called you a polymath in the introduction there. You've written an amazing book about BBC Radio 1, an amazing book about typefaces called Just My Type, which was a hit a couple of years ago. How do you choose your subjects? Suddenly we are on maps.
Well, you know, the obvious answer, I pick them up with my apples at Sainsbury's. I think I'm just drawn by good yarns, and also things that sort of give me an education, you know. So I kind of love exploring worlds that I'm just unfamiliar with, that I'm obviously interested in some cases passionate about as well. So I was always interested in type. I mean, I think if you're a writer, or maybe even if you just have a computer with a pull-down menu, you're going to be a bit interested in typefaces and hopefully where they come from. And that was the idea of Just My Type. And with maps, I've been sort of collecting maps, although on a very small scale, mostly the London tube map, since I was a kid. And I just kind of thought, well, okay, there's got to be an accessible way of telling great tales, but also trying to sort of tell, I suppose, a history through maps, a history of the world through maps. I mean, obviously, the book is only 450 pages long, so it's anything but a definitive tale. But the idea is to take, I think in the end we ended up with 39 maps for some reason, and just sort of explain their significance, not only who made them, but obviously, you know, what picture of the world we get from them. And some of them are very big kind of world maps, and we look at the development of, you know, from three continents to four to five, and the development, and I look at the arrival of the poles and Antarctica and all of that, and the naming of America and those big events. And then some of them are very small, So I look at just a map in Soho in London, which is a famous outbreak of cholera in the 1850s, and how the mapping of that helped define, you know, how where it came from, really, which was a water pump. And then, as you say, right up to Google, and I went over to Mountain View in California to talk to the PE.
Is this the Googleplex?
The Googleplex. Google Maps has a separate building, as you might imagine.
And sounds a bit Aldous Huxley. Sounds a bit frightening. Sounds a bit Ballardian.
It sort of is frightening. It's not frightening, but I mean, the PE people there are very, very nice and very accessible. And it is your classic sort of, 2012 IT sort of playground or IT tech playground, you know.
Did you have to go on a slide to get in?
You can't actually...
Space up a raceway to the office.
Exactly, you can't...
Pick a beanbag, any beanbag.
Talk to anyone without... It is. You've got to be able to play basketball and pool and skate and everything else before you're allowed in there.
Yeah.
Exactly, it's just like Monocle. And the whole idea of that is... they wouldn't be as boastful. Perhaps they would not in front of a visitor. But they actually sort of run the world of mapping now. Good for good and bad. Mm. And actually, with the arrival of Apple Maps and the disaster of that, you kind of realise how all powerful Google are. Mm. And they have a sign though. The most remarkable thing that I found when I went there, and I talk about this in the book. They talked a bit about their plans for future mapping and how they do it and sending people out with, you know, and obviously we're familiar with a Google car going around streets, but going to places where cars can't go with sort of these, sort of a bit like something out of Doctor Who with these cameras on your back, all-seeing cameras and huge eyes. But the most scary thing I found was a sign which a signpost made out of wood, brand new, but actually it looked like it had been made 100 years ago because it had been sort of chipped away. And it was a signpost to all the conference rooms in Google Maps HQ. And it had names like Magellan and Francis Drake and Shackleton and people. So basically everyone who'd kind of mapped the world and explored the world before it brought us to this point, were on this signpost, and the conference rooms were all named after them. But actually, the real thinking was, and the reason this post was here, was that actually Google had won. You know, Google had sort of combined all of this now into the map.
Simon, have we reached a point now where it's actually impossible to sort of better our mapping of the world?
No, I mean, it's not at all, really. I mean, I think what's going to happen... First of all, you know, even though the satellites are sort of seen everywhere now, so you can say the world is mapped, there are huge areas that aren't mapped or aren't properly mapped. Antarctica, if you look at it, it's still essentially kind of white space. I mean, if someone goes there, they say, OK, well, I've been here, and I'm going to call it kind of, Monocle Island or whatever it is. But actually, it's... it's really sort of insubstantial. And there are great areas in the world as well that either have only local maps, which you sort of know mental maps, really, you know, but trying to get around Tokyo, you know, as well, the map actually isn't much use. You sort of have to know little pockets and little areas and what's in your head, and you have to obviously ask for direction.
Did you try mapping yourself? Or you...
Mapping myself or as not a person yourself in the world, you mean?
No, did you actually go around and try and...
No, I did try and add a little bit. There's something called Open Street Map, which is sort of an alternative to the big corporate maps where you kind of add bits yourself as you go along. So if you know about a new cul-de-sac that's just been made, you know, up sort of where you live, you can put that on, and Google or whoever it is, or TomTom or whoever, wouldn't maybe know that that was there for another 6 months until they went round again, so you can do that. But I think what's going to happen is that we are really at the infancy of digital mapping, and they will be far more, you know, now we're at the centre of digital maps, so they're far more tailored to what we want to know. So, you know, you can get, I came here on a bike, and you can get specific bike maps, but they're pretty clunky. And so a complete bike map when you're riding around would be, you know, with just bike lanes, for instance, would be a kind of fantastic thing. So there'll be layers and layers and layers. So we are very much, I think, at the early days.
And And that was Rob and Hugo MacDonald talking to Simon Garfield. We'll be back right after this.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Rob Bound.
Dr. Ben Goldacre has been calling out the less credible arguments of the medical sector via his website, books, and a weekly newspaper column for the last few years. Ben's latest book is Bad Pharma, casting a critical eye over the pharmaceutical industry's mixed messages. He joined us back in September to tell us why your regular prescription might not be quite what the doctor ordered. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You dedicate the book to whom it may concern, which I kind of like that. Presumably it's all of us. We should all be, should we all be afraid?
Yes. Well, it is a 90,000 word long letter of complaint. You know, like I you don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book. So I had to find something which could only be explained in a book. And this is a huge problem, and it's a huge problem which has been allowed to persist because it's been hidden from public scrutiny, partly because it's technical and partly because I think people are reasonably entitled to expect that doctors and senior academics and regulators will fix the problems that I describe. But the fact is they haven't after several decades. And I kind of feel like sunlight is the best disinfectant and shame is a very potent motivator. So I'm hoping that enough people will read this, that that it will drive change, because people really do suffer and die unnecessarily. And it's a very, very peculiar situation that we've allowed to arise.
And this isn't bad doctors, this is bad pharma. This is, I mean, you cast most of your ire towards the large pharmaceutical manufacturers, the drug industry.
Well, them, but also the senior doctors and academics and regulators who have either conspired or been complacent and lazy about these problems. You know, I'm not a kind of deranged anti-capitalist, anti-corporate campaigner. We need drug companies to make drugs, and we need drugs in medicine. There is no medicine without medicines. But unfortunately, the incentives are currently so perverse that, firstly, drug companies are allowed to get away with behaving very badly. We know, for example, that half of all of the trials that are conducted never get published. They're withheld from doctors and patients. So we know that we are misled about the true effects of the treatments that we give on a daily basis in medicine. But there are also then kind of interesting second round problems that are created by flawed regulation. So, for example, to get a drug on the market, you don't have to show that it's better than what we currently have. In fact, you don't even have to compare it against what we currently have. And so as a result, the market is absolutely full of these Me Too drugs, copycat drugs. Now, the problem with that is it means that there's no innovation, or it means that the drive to innovation is much less than it should be. So we heard just this week that that a couple of big drug companies are pulling out of Alzheimer's research, for example, saying that they can't get anywhere. Now, there's no doubt that these are difficult problems to solve. But at the same time, with the pharmaceutical industry, we're talking about a $700 billion global industry, which spends twice as much of its revenue on marketing as it does on research and development. And that's something which is obviously not going to create innovative new products.
It sounds like Hollywood. It sounds like we're kind of stuck with people not knowing that they're watching crap movies, so we keep on getting the same movie made the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, it really is like kind of Hollywood medicine. It's like X Factor medicine.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
The bigger you are as a company, the more marketing oomph you've got to put behind a completely bland, uninnovative Me Too drug, the more money you'll get back off it.
And you know, your book comes up with some ideas. It's not a book that's just a complaint. You have some ideas towards the end of the book about how the industry should be changed and what could be done to shake up this. Because you go for everything from people who put themselves forward to medical trials to the wooing of doctors with gifts. You go through every level showing how at every turn something seems to go wrong.
So I think that we need an amnesty of all the trials that have ever been conducted. I think they need to all be published. And all of the drug companies around the world have records on this stuff, and they're all buried in you know, secure dry storage archives in the hills of Cheshire. And I think, you know, it's a trivial amount of money to just get it all scanned and put it all in a huge public archive and let doctors and academics start picking their way through it and work out what works. And then going forwards, we need legislation that means that drug companies are never again allowed to bury bad data.
Well, for the time being, put your pills back in your pockets, lads. The book is Bad Pharma. It's out this week. Dr. Ben Goldacre, thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Thanks, boss.
During the past year, our inaugural leap into the world of radio broadcasting, Midori House has been alive with visiting musicians.
It's something we'd planned on, obviously, but nonetheless, the treat of having Kylie come in and break up a Monday morning meeting about stationery supplies or Scissor Sisters stepping to man the front desk is something we haven't taken for granted.
Back in July, Jason Charles Beck, better known as electro-rap prankster, classically trained pianist and Grammy-nominated producer Chilly Gonzalez, performed a beautiful session to a rapt Midori House crowd. He joined Rob for a chat after, but first off, here he is in front of the Midori House faithful playing a track called White Keys.
Chilly, thanks for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. There are all sorts of facets. We're going to hear some solo piano, too, which is the new record.
That's right.
This is a very pure thing, isn't it? Does it come from a very sort of pure place? It's got a very clean sound.
Well, the sound itself isn't actually clean at all if you compare it to how piano records are made in the classical and jazz world these days. Right. It's very ping, 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 very antiseptic. So actually, we sort of do more of a room recording, more like they recorded back in the 40s and 50s. But that's neither here nor there. If we're talking about purity, I would say that, yes, the idea that, you know, these are live takes of something that happened in that room on an upright piano, the kind of piano you could imagine, you know, in your hallway growing up.
Uh-huh. I think about a pub knees up. That's dirty upright piano. This sounds more like pure upright.
Well, piano. It sounds more like what we associate with musical intimacy, I think. Uh-huh. You know, a grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point, in a way. So, like today at the session here at the Monocle session, I'm going to be doing my show on an upright piano as well, because I'm going to be trying to recreate some of the intimacy of the album. So all of that contributes to what I would call sort of a close-up. You know, if Chilly Gonzalez is a movie doing sometimes orchestral rap and popping up in strange places like the iPad commercial and a Daft Punk album, mm-hmm. all of that is only possible because of the piano. You know, when Daft Punk calls me to play on their album, it's to play the piano. It's not to rap. It's not to be conceptual. Uh-huh. It's not to make them laugh. I'm there for a pretty specific reason. It's what I can do on the piano. And so I consider it a close-up amongst the more wilder scenes in the Chilly Gonzalez movie that's been sort of ongoing now for about 12 years.
All right, well, tell me about the Chilly Gonzalez movie that's been going on. I mean, it's an exciting movie. It's sort of a bit of a thriller. It's a bit of an action movie. There's all sorts of things.
Well, for those who
chucked
know,
into that
that's
suit.
That's right. For
right,
those who know, but you know, I put a lot of effort into the sort of backstory, mm-hmm. and I put a lot of effort into making sure that when I release an album, I try to explain more than just where the music came from, but where the entire message comes from. And when I say message, it's because, you know, I consider myself an entertainer. So I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
This idea of the entertainer is an interesting one. And the idea of filling in the blanks, because a lot of musicians aren't particularly great at talking about their work or their facade that they perhaps present. A lot of people kind of go, well, the music does the talking, man. But you're different to that. There's a kind of idea of, there's a definite theatricality to it. Solo Piano Number 2, the new record, does that strip away that theatricality, or is that part of the entertainer? Is this part of the persona, this intimate side of you?
Well, the theatrical side is the most literal link with what people think of as entertainment. You know, I think Daft Punk are great entertainers. Uh-huh. They've never opened their mouths for an interview in their lives. I mean, they don't even show their faces, but they found something really poetic with those robot masks and their iconography. And so it touches you, you know? It's a very different take than I do. I have a more big mouthed entertainer comedian side, but of course I also think the purity we were talking about of solo piano 1 and 2, mm-hmm. That's part of entertainment too, because I'm really thinking of my audience. I'm literally picturing them, the ones I see on my 100 shows a year. I'm literally want to really get something through to them. So I do consider intimacy, extreme intimacy, a huge part of entertainment as well. Yes, to sort of look at me, that part of me, that's a more literal way. That's a way to get attention. But once you have people's attention, you have to show different sides, of course. I don't think it would have lasted this long if I'd only been the look at me guy. And so I've been careful to always make sure the backstory is like you get to know a person. You know, sometimes you get to know a really gregarious, slightly socially dominant entertainer. You'll meet a guy like that, and you might like him, and then you might start to hate him a little bit. He might transgress, and then in a certain moment, he'll reveal maybe why he's like that, and you'll start to understand more about him. I think if you become a fan of Chilly Gonzalez, you're going to go through something like that.
Well, Chilly Gonzalez, the legend and the artist, but more so the entertainer. Thank you so much for joining us on the week.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Rob talking with Chilly Gonzalez. We'll be back right after this with more from the past year on the Monocle Weekly.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Back in July 2012, Monocle 24 was visited by Alistair Campbell, former press secretary for Tony Blair and a figure at the heart of UK government during the run-up to the Iraq War.
It's been nearly a decade since the war drew up an all-new political landscape, both at home and abroad. And, unfortunately, the conflict itself also stayed with us until 2011. With Iraq still a fractured society marred by insurgency and violence today, for Alistair Campbell, questions of the legitimacy of the invasion by Western Allied forces in 2003 are not going away.
When he visited Monocle 24 studios back in the summer, foreign correspondent Steve Bloomfield didn't waste any time getting into the thick of things.
Alistair Campbell, thank you very much for
my pleasure
coming into Midori House. I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Because in the view of the British government, Saddam Hussein was a threat. And I think there's a line in the book where I say to Tony, look, if this brings about your, as it were, premature end politically, which it might, is it really worth it? And he said, I think, something that I think guided him the whole way through. He said, look, it's always worth doing what you think is the right thing. And Saddam has been ignored for far too long, and that includes by Britain. And it's interesting, one of the benefits of keeping a diary is that you can recall things that you can't remember. I had completely forgotten that the day before September the 10th, we went for lunch at the Guardian, and it was Mike White who reminded me that that day... That day, Tony had said, the big coming issue is rogue states, weapons of mass destruction and terrorist organisations. Now, that was September the 10th. So I think, you know, as lots of people said, Saddam had been not tolerated, but people had turned a blind eye. And the phrase that kept being used was the calculus of threat had changed. And where before people were willing to take a risk on doubt, now they weren't. And when I say people, I mean particularly the Americans, but also us and other countries that were in the alliance that then took him out.
But despite all that, you were still, the government was still willing to accept that Saddam Hussein could stay in power. It was the fact that he had weapons of mass destruction that was the main issue.
Well, I think if Saddam Hussein, even at the last, even before, just before the military action began, if he had credibly signalled that he intended to stand by his international obligations, then I think, could war have been averted? I think possibly. But I think by then, his record was so clear, his message of defiance was so clear, it kind of wasn't going to happen. And you see, what our critics try to do is say, oh, well, you know, you just wanted to do it because George Bush wanted to do it. And 9/11 gave you the sort of pretext and the excuse. And so you dreamed up this whole WMD thing. This is the kind of conspiracy theory that goes against us. I mean, I just say to people, go and read all the United Nations resolutions going way back. And when you talk about regime change, I mean, the Clinton administration had a policy of regime change. Bush, as it were, inherited that.
The UK government view wasn't that regime change was necessary.
It wasn't. The UK government view was that, one, he had to be made to face up to his international obligations under the UN resolutions of which he'd been in defiance, that he was a particular threat because of weapons of mass destruction. That is true. Now, as has been thrown back at us millions of times with some justification, we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction after he fell. Now, my view on that is the intelligence can't all have been wrong. And what the other thing to remember is we know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that. But the point about the threat that we were dealing with was that, and why Tony was so concerned about this, was because, and I can remember him saying, I don't want to be the Prime Minister who wakes up one day and finds that what we're warning about now, this coming together of weapons of mass destruction, rogue states and terrorist groups, that it happens on his watch and we warned about it, but we didn't actually act on it. So I think the acting on it was obviously, clearly it was a big decision and a difficult decision, and it's still very, very unpopular. I know that. But it's one of those things where you're not taking that decision in hindsight. He was taking that decision then, where the intelligence was pointing in a very clear direction. And, OK, that's all been unpicked, and you've had the Butler inquiry, you've had the Chilcot inquiry. But even with all that, I still think, I still support what Tony Blair did. Having seen him dealing with the decision at that time, not now in hindsight, but then.
There was obviously a lot of thought given to how the war started.
Yeah.
I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but you know how you get to this situation where it is dealt with.
Mm.
You know, you talk about that a lot in your diaries. There's very little in anyone's books about what happened pre-2003, and including from what I've seen so far in yours, about, okay, if this does happen, what happens next?
No, there was a hell of a lot of planning went on, but you've got to remember, this is my diary, okay, and I'm the guy who's in charge of communications and strategy, so it's coming at it from a very different position. I was doing a talk the other night, one of the universities in London, and there were a couple of guys there came to see me afterwards who'd been involved in on the intelligence side, on planning and analysis, and all that was going on. There was, but my point is that and everybody knows this happens in military conduct. Nothing ever goes totally according to plan.
Mm.
And when you say, why didn't we predict that Al-Qaeda would have kind of poured in their resources there? Because at the time, the analysis was that the threat that they were going to pose would have been an attempt to provoke a reaction here or in America or in some of the other capitals of the countries that were involved. That's just, and if you think about it, that's a fairly obvious thing to have thought. And so my point is that you deal with the unexpected, but on that big picture, to go back to your very, very first question, was there deemed to be a threat that had to be taken seriously? Yes, there was. So it's easy to sort of just look at one bit of it and say, and you know, we have to accept, as everybody has accepted, that things went wrong and that things, that you know, it went on too long, that too many people died who weren't directly involved and so forth. But on that big picture, did the world ignore Saddam for too long? Yes. Was it the right thing to take him on in the way that we did? I think it was, and I still support what Tony Blair did.
That was Monocle's Steve Bloomfield talking to Alastair Campbell.
At the start of the year, one of the all-too-regular surges in violence in Afghanistan meant Monocle 24 felt it was time to put the continuing conflict in context. Sophie Grove, Andrew and I were joined by acclaimed filmmaker, author and investigative journalist Ben Anderson to help understand the outlook for Afghanistan in 2012.
Ben is a much-storied individual with a list of achievements too long to list entirely. So let's go back to April and hear Rob's attempt to do it anyway.
I Our first guest is a journalist, filmmaker and author who, whether he's reporting from the front line of Afghanistan or exposing the bottom line of rip-off undertakers as an undercover reporter, seems to be putting himself on the line at all times. Ben Anderson has been described as the bravest journalist I know by fellow filmmaker Louis Theroux, and with a recent surge of violence this week in Afghanistan, he's here to explain why insurgent activity is on the rise and also tell us what projects he's working on. Ben, a very warm welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
That's quite an introduction, isn't it?
That is, yeah.
When I said you're the bravest journalist I know, you sort of made a face as if I just made that quote up.
I just think that's a reflection on who Louis Theroux knows rather than what I've done.
Well, we'll kick off slightly seriously. Obviously, all the stuff that's been going on in Afghanistan this week, is this just simply taking the precedent that you've seen out there, for all the years you've been reporting?
It's happened at the start of every fighting season for the last few years. It's a statement attack. They didn't aim to hold any ground. They were people who were willing to die, and it was a fairly small number of fairly inept attackers with light arms and RPGs. So it's just to make a statement. They're still there, and they can still attack right next to the main embassies and ISAF HQ in Kabul. The problem is in the south. That's where the war is being fought, and that's where the real struggles are happening. There will always be these spectacular attacks in Kabul. It doesn't actually change very much. Kandahar and Helmand is where the problems are.
And what is the context for the fighting season? Is it something to do with the Taliban and their sort of culture?
No, it's purely practical. It's so cold in the south in the winter. I've been out there over winters, and you wake up with ice on your sleeping bag. It's miserable. It's no way to fight, especially not if you're wearing sandals and living in people's back gardens for weeks, which is what the Taliban do. So a lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
I was with Monocle in Geneva last week, and we went to a conference of mayors, and the mayor of Kabul was there, unfortunately, just a day before the attacks, and he was persuading me actually how wonderful Kabul was and how peaceful and calm it is. When you go there, do you see this strict division between actually what's happening in a city like Kabul and then, as you say, when you head out to somewhere like Helmand?
Yeah, I mean, I think our big fault there from 2001 onwards is that we've kept the fighting along the same divide that it's always been along. And so it's the Southern Pashtuns versus the Northern Alliance headed by the Tajiks. And, at the minute, the policy is to train the Afghan National Army and National Police to take over from us. Well, it's not a national army. It's not a national police force. They don't even speak the same language as the Southern Pashtuns. So I've been on dozens of operations with British and American forces, and they'll clear a town of the Taliban and a few days later bring in the police and the army. And every single time I've seen that happen, the same thing has happened. The local people have come up to me or the troops and said, please don't leave us alone with the Afghan National Police, because they're their historical enemies and they're there for revenge. They're well known for abducting and raping children. They're well known for taxing people at checkpoints. They're not seen as national army at all. The Southern Pashtuns make up roughly 3% maximum of the national army. And that's the problem. And my fear is that as soon as we leave, there's going to be a civil war again along exactly the same lines as the civil war.
Because that happened. Is the Taliban mainly drawn from the Pashtuns?
Yeah, not all Pashtuns are Taliban, but pretty much all Taliban are Pashtun. And I'm convinced that certainly in the south, the people we're fighting aren't linked in any way to the Taliban of 2001 that hosted Al-Qaeda. They're just angry farmers who want the foreign troops out of their land. And they want the unwelcome, corrupt and incompetent Afghan army and police and government out of their backyards as well.
Can I ask a slightly different question? Over the years, you've made an amazing array of films. I'm looking at the list of everything about gang wars in El Salvador, about gay rights in America, pollution in Varanasi. What was your kind of starting point on this journey into being a filmmaker and to being a writer?
I think it was growing up in a really small, dull town. I used to walk home from school over this hill through a cemetery, and I remember I used to be on top of this hill and look at Bedford town. It was just rows and rows of these semi-detached houses, and the little living room light was on, and everyone was sitting down having dinner. And I used to be physically angry that that was all there was for me. That if I did a job that I didn't particularly like for my entire life, that was all I'd have, was one of those little boxes on a hill in Bedford.
And your route out was a journalism course or going to filmmaking school?
No, I studied philosophy. I travelled for 3 or 4 years and read a lot, and I liked philosophy. So I went to King's College and studied philosophy, but quit after a year because it was 5 one-hour lectures a week, and I had to pay my way through university. And then after that, got into the undercover filmmaking. And from teenage years onwards, just stories about Congo, Palestine, Iraq, they always seemed like the most important things in the world to me. Just gut instinct, I felt that. And I always wanted to cover that in some way or work in that in some way. and I still feel the same way now. I mean, I was looking at Syria recently, and then the pasty scandal bumped Syria off the news, and to this day it still amazes me that such news stories can bump such important stories like Syria off the news agenda. It still stuns me now.
How do you see it? I mean, in places like Syria, this sort of stuff is obviously not covered. Do you sometimes feel that there is too much sort of levity to the news? And finally, stories are at the top of the news rather than the bottom of the hour.
It feels like we're going the American way, where news is entertainment. And it feels like we're assuming that most viewers have to be sort of tricked into watching serious foreign stories. And actually, most people I speak to are really curious about what's happening in the rest of the world. They're just not getting the information they want in the way they want. But yeah, I'm stunned by especially when I watch, you know, 6 o'clock news or 10 o'clock news. I'm stunned by what leads the news. I'm stunned that I've covered Congo for quite a few times, and that's 4.5 million people at least killed since 1996, more than any war since World War II. And I can't get backing to go out there. I rarely see it covered in the papers at all. And you know, in some ways, I've become cynical over the years, but it still amazes me that a story like that is unknown to most people. And it also amazes me that it seems that newspapers and TV stations can only really do one major foreign story at a time. And yet, you know, we know there are dozens of conflicts going on around, dozens of crises going on around the world. And most of them, for whatever reason, just get completely forgotten about or never covered in the first place.
That was Ben Anderson speaking in April 2012.
It's Sunday, we're nearly at the end of our gluttonous radio feast. Probably time to relax things a little. Perhaps an afternoon stroll might be in order.
One person who finds pleasure in the detail when walking the open spaces of his home city is London landscape architect and gardener Todd Longstaff-Gowan. Todd's book, The London Square, takes a leisurely look through the stories and history that have shaped the green spaces around us.
They may not be very green right now, but let's go back to the beginning of June 2012 to end the show on a sunny note and give us all something to look forward to in 2013.
Sophie Grove and I took this one, but it's also time for Robert Bound and I to take off. We'll be back next week, but for now, from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Robert Bound.
Goodbye.
Tell me about the London Square. Do you think, from your research, that London more or less invented the square?
Oh, without question. And I think what's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city. And although it's been adopted in other countries, cities across Britain and abroad, it's always been at home in London. And it has to do with so many things that we love here and so many things we hate about ourselves as well. So everything from snobbery to enclosure and other things like this. But it's a fantastic, it's sort of an encapsulation of the average Londoner.
And how did it all start? I mean, we have so many squares here, especially Victorian ones and ones from the 18th century. What's the evolution of the square?
Squares really, when London is trying to sort of reinvent itself as a more cosmopolitan international city in the late 16th, early 17th century, we look abroad because we're travelling more often to the continent. And we look at these, what we call these dusty open piazzas that you see, or place, on the continent. And we bring it back home, but we're not happy just having, as it were, regular buildings surrounding our open spaces. We decide we have to elaborate them, and they later become gardens. But it's really the marriage of two traditions, a continental regular piazza with sort of palace fronts around it, with the London and English tradition of our common, with just green. And really the first squares are just big open spaces with a little bit of greenery, and they become gardens much later.
Now, in London, there's a kind of a strange piece of history, isn't there? Because these squares were not really kind of open to everyone when they were first built. They were mainly kind of fenced off, and you had to be a resident to get into them.
Absolutely, and that's been the tradition because they were often built in the centre of large urban estates. And the landowners realised that what's unusual about London is that most of the great people who lived here because they had to for business, but preferred to live in the country. So the square was a wonderful thing because it brought people together who would ordinarily not want to live a mile apart. And they were forced to live in these very small, close quarters, but they live in these great sort of town palaces that surrounded these open spaces. And they would pay for this amenity and for its maintenance because we have this tradition, as you know, that we always like to enclose things to make them feel better and make them look better. And we always think that if you put a fence around something, that it's going to behave. And it's this idea also of exclusion. And this is really what appeals to everyone, is that you can take a space. And the first spaces aren't elaborated and are left open. They realise that they're subject to the most terrible depravities. Everything from dumping cats and rubbish to firework displays and horrible displays of antisocial behaviour. So it's really important, they think, to enclose these. So these are really pre-parliamentary enclosures.
There is a hint of sex and bawdiness about our squares as well.
Absolutely, and this is the curious thing about it. There's nothing more attractive, of course, than something you can't get into. And, of course, you have to realise, even just within the square itself, I mean, a very interesting case is Lincoln's and Fields, which was formed as a wonderful garden. Prior to that, it had been a public open space. From the 1740s or 1730s, they enclose it, becomes this garden. And it becomes this wonderful idyllic place. But towards the end of the 18th century, when the gardens are very overgrown, the residential occupation reduces in scale, and you start have young bucks or lawyers moving in. And these chaps decide, well, the gardens are actually quite a good place to philander, so they start taking prostitutes into the gardens. And the difficulty is, of course, that the guards and the beadles look after the square can't really kick them out because they're paying a rate. So they have to sort of, for a while, put up with this until they change the rules. But also servants who lived in the houses all around the square were very fond of using the gardens after hours as well, and because they would steal the keys or just borrow the keys and get into the gardens. And there are wonderful accounts in the early 19th century of servants' screams keeping their masters awake in the morning. But there are any number of things like that, and it really becomes a very popular sort of resort, as it were. And that persists throughout the centuries. But it's quite natural, too, that... and also, you know, under the cover of the shrubs, statues were dismantled, any number of things took place. So it's really a fascinating part of the underbelly.
Can I ask, this might be an agonising question, do you have a favourite square?
Not one, but several, I suppose. There are a few which I think are exemplary. I mean, Edward Square is among the best, I think, really. It was designed curiously by a Frenchman, but it's a fantastic square in West London and very low-rise sort of cottages around it. But still, when you're in the midst of that square, you feel you're in the middle of the countryside. Then I'd say any of those gardens around the Ladbroke Estate are pretty good. And my favourite of those is Stanley Crescent Gardens. But there are so many that offer different aspects. But I think that those are two of my favourites.
And without revealing too much, do you happen to live on a square?
No, not at all.
Oh, no!
Can't afford it.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today about your wonderful book. And this book is called The London Square. And it's out now?
It is indeed, yes, published by Yale University Press.
And so we can find this on in newsstands or rather in bookshops from the US to the UK?
Yes, it should be available everywhere.
Good, we like that idea. Well,
thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to see it, and it is an amazing book. And Todd Longstaff-Gowan, good luck with your promotion of it.
Thank you.